We get to the obvious and Tennessee losing on Saturday night to Kentucky. How about the start for the Tennessee Vols baseball team? I don't care who you're playing. If you're talking about college baseball, and not that you're off to the 3-0 start, but the fact that you shut out Appalachian State in all three games, it's only been done twice ever in the history of Tennessee baseball. You have to go back. I mean, think about this, what the historic run for Tennessee basketball. And here's the baseball team, 1916 and 1965, when Tennessee in previous series have been able to hold an opponent, scoreless for an entire weekend.
Yeah, no, it was very surprising. And these are the type of games that Tennessee would lose one of, right? Or even lately lose the series, you know, against an Appalachian State. So, to not just get the sweep, but to also, I mean, hold them scoreless, that's still pretty good. I got to tell you, the way that they've redone the stadium, that's a tough spot. It's really, really tough the way that the stadium's built here in Knoxville there on campus. Not a lot of parking, not a whole lot of room. The facilities aren't necessarily great, but they upgraded the field, got new uniforms and things like that this year that are kind of redesigned, a little bit of a throwback. And I have to tell you, they've Tony Vitello's done a very good job kind of re-energizing this program a little bit. Looks like the kids have bought in.
Let's turn to Saturday night. And, and Rick Barnes was talking about selfish play. But the bottom line is that Kentucky was ready and Tennessee wasn't.
No, and yes, absolutely. And also, all of those things that Tennessee gained a reputation for, that this group of Tennessee players has gained a reputation for, being the physical aggressor every single possession, putting a body into somebody, diving on the floor for loose balls, Kentucky was the team that did that. Tennessee wasn't. Tennessee got hit in their mouth. They let guys that are, frankly, 15 to 20 pounds outside of Reed Travis, smaller than them, shove them around. And Kentucky, credit their coaching staff, credit the players. From the difference in what we saw in their ability to protect the rim and protect the paint versus, you know, Tuesday night against LSU to what they were Saturday was absolutely incredible. Tennessee probably needed that. Tennessee probably needed to get hit in their mouth. They probably needed to get humiliated like that on a big national stage and probably needed to hear people say, you got exposed, because I do think they got exposed, not for being an overrated team necessarily, but for being a team that's been resting on their laurels for a little while. They haven't been the team that's been diving on loose balls. They have kind of, you know, messed around a little too much on the offensive end and taken their foot off the gas, you know, too often during games. I would also say, Johnny, they've allowed too many open three-pointers to teams like, you know, South Carolina and things like that. And because of their execution on the offensive end and knocking down jump shots, they've been able to survive through that. And so in this game, I mean, you saw, it's always interesting to me because you always see like Calipari, Krzyzewski, Izzo. There are just those games that you'll see them sit down for the majority of the game and just let their guys get their brains beat in. And this was that game for Rick Barnes where he just sat there. I've never seen him sit this much on the sideline. He sat there at Rupp and just watched his guys get beat down. And it's probably the best thing that could have happened to him.
Well, and certainly when you look at the box score, the thing that really sticks out that to me defines what transpired over the 40 minutes at Rupp was just how much Kentucky dominated the boards. And when you talk about the physical play, to me, Kentucky was more physical. They were tougher. And as you pointed out as well, they wanted the loose balls. Because otherwise you look at the fact that things that you want out of a team going on the road in this kind of environment, I mean, Tennessee took care of the basketball, only 9 turnovers for the entire game. But to me, what really sticks out is the huge advantage Kentucky had in rebounding.
No, and you look at something like Harrow. Harrow weighs 195, right? They run a 3-out-2-in motion offense. This is effort. That's what that was at the end of the day. Kentucky had the effort. Kentucky was the aggressor. PJ Washington is frankly weaker than both Admiral Schofield and Grant Williams, and he pushed those guys around for the majority of the game. And Harrow did a great job of getting into the paint. And Tennessee is one of the things that they've talked about for a while, Johnny, as Rick Barnes is, and Admiral Schofield both have talked about, we're not boxing out well enough. We're not boxing out well enough. Well, Kentucky burned them for it. And Tennessee is kind of, it reminds me of a fighter who gets fat, or, you know, who racks up a bunch of wins fighting tomato cans. And then you see him get in the ring with somebody real, right? I mean, how many times have you seen, oh, this guy's 20-0 in his career. He's not fought anybody. Tennessee got to a 19-game winning streak, beating tomato cans, especially down the stretch, and barely surviving with maybe a beneficial whistle against Vanderbilt and, you know, against South Carolina, allowing them to shoot over 50% from beyond the arc, getting out-rebounded by teams like Missouri. And Tennessee needed to get this punch in the face. They said it after the game, and I hope that they get it, that hey, you can't walk out there, just roll the basketball out, think you're the number one team in the nation. What got them the number one was that they outworked everybody. They out-executed everybody. And they just flat didn't against Kentucky, and it showed.
Having a chance once again to talk a little Tennessee and more with Will West over in Knoxville, Sports Radio WNML. How was the reaction today? Is it one of these things where, it's not the worst thing in the world? I go back to, I thought a huge plus for Kentucky going into this matchup is the same kind of thing that can be a huge plus for Tennessee going on the road against LSU on Saturday after Vanderbilt tomorrow night. And that is the fact that, here's Kentucky. They fell to LSU in that close heartbreaker at the end, and I think that certainly the coaches were able to get the full attention of his players as far as going into this matchup on Saturday night.
Yeah, I think that is the goal, it looks like, for Tennessee. That's what they are saying. That's what Rick Barnes said today. That's what the Tennessee players said after Saturday, was, hey, we needed something to get our attention. Admiral Schofield said after the game, this we've had trouble keeping our focus as of late, and this should wake us up. It should wake him up. Now, you still have to show up and do it, because Will Wake can coach, and that is not a great – that's a tough environment for basketball down there in Baton Rouge. So you got to handle your business, and you got to get past Vandy. It isn't like Vandy – if you didn't get a favorable whistle there in Memorial, I don't know that Tennessee walks out of there against Vandy with a win. So, it's one game at a time right now for them, but they have a lot to clean up. They have a whole lot to clean up. And you're right. I mean, Kentucky was a team – that struggled to protect the rim for the majority of the season. They played a lot of finesse basketball. They're kind of a finesse team. Nobody had really exploited them for that for quite a while. And then my thought was that, they were so bad at protecting the rim against LSU, there's no way you're getting all of that fixed that quickly. They did. They absolutely did. And you got to tip the cap to Kentucky's coaches, Kentucky's players, for having their team prepared for that game on Saturday and fixing a ton of issues defensively, and really when it comes to aggressions.
Everybody that's a fan of this basketball squad wants it to make a long run once it gets to postseason, as far as the big dance is concerned. Things that you saw on Saturday night, what concerns you most for that to be a reality?
Well, they have, and I've said this for 2 weeks on our program, Johnny, Tennessee has the tendencies of a giant that gets slayed by a Goliath that gets slayed by a David in the NCAA tournament. They turn it on and turn it off whenever they want to, right? That they get to switch, that they can turn off, and they allow too many open three-pointers. If you talk about the NCAA tournament, when you see UMBC knock off Virginia, when you see Northern Iowa knock off Kansas, what happens? Open looks, extra pass, open three, they knock down the three. Tennessee has got to get better at defending the perimeter. They've got to realize that it has to be every possession. That's what got them there. That's what got them to the number one ranking in the nation. Somewhere down the stretch, they've just let their foot off the gas a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. And it went from after the Arkansas game, where they're up by 20 and then end up winning by like 19, and they got outscored in the second half. They're angry with themselves for getting outscored in the second half, right? The teams beside themselves, Barnes is livid because they got outscored in the second half. And then by the time you get to the South Carolina game, you win by 12. And you're saying, we still won the game. Yeah, they shot well beyond the arc, but we still won the game. They've got to hold themselves accountable the way that they held themselves accountable before they had success. That's going to be the biggest thing that Tennessee has to do if they want to make a run in March.
Well, when you – and by the way, I think you hit the nail on the head right there, because some of those potential teams say the difference between a – ending the season as an Elite Eight squad or advancing to a Final Four could be the difference of getting by Nevada or Houston or Marquette, one of those teams. And that's why Saturday night was so important. And I'll be certainly looking forward to seeing how this team responds, not only with Vanderbilt coming to town, although based on what transpired Saturday, this is probably the worst situation for a Vanderbilt team, coming to this ball game now with a 13-game losing streak, which is one more away from the all-time losing streak in the program's history. But I think certainly I'm looking forward to what happens on Saturday in Baton Rouge against LSU as well.
No, yeah, it's Tough for Vandy. Can I ask you this? Is Bryce Drew, is he going to survive this year? I mean, will
yes.
he be back next year?
He will survive, but if he has a repeat performance, I would not expect that to be the case. Okay. Now, we say this, but you don't – I mean, we have the new AD at Vanderbilt, certainly coming from a basketball background, and this may be his pet project, and he may have folks in mind for the men's and women's squad. We don't know. I mean, here's the thing. Honestly, you know, it's – If you look at the things that really stand out to me about this Vanderbilt squad during this losing streak, you can almost count on, first of all, which is something you never want to see, is not just turning the ball over more than assists, but usually two times the amount. And same thing that happened on Saturday. And usually you can also count in the fact that the team is shooting 62% or less from the free throw line. Now, Saturday was the exception. They took care of at least that part of it at home, shooting around 76%. But also not finishing games in the last 3 or 4 minutes of these ball games. And it's not just one occasion or two. It wasn't just like, you know, the chance to beat the number one team in the country in Tennessee. This has happened over and over. It's like Groundhog's Day. And that would be a concern to me, because that is right there fully on the lap of the coaches, not being able to teach the players how to finish games one play at a time. And to me, that starts with coaching.
Yeah, no, you're right, and discipline. I mean, we see it with the Lady Ball basketball team here right now in Tennessee, that they'll be in a game for three quarters in, and then somehow down the stretch they get blown out. So, yeah, that speaks a lot to coaching. It speaks a lot to not holding your players accountable for the way that they treat the basketball and for making sure they get into what they need to do offensively instead of trying to get into transition or trying to go schoolyard ball or play isolation.
Well, you brought up a good point, Justin, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this one, because the last thing I want to hear coming out of the mouth of a coach on a losing team, from a losing team, I don't want to hear compliments about the effort. Because as I was saying, you know, to me, it's just like getting up, putting one pant leg on one at a time, brushing your teeth. Effort is a thing that, you know, only time you ever bring it up is when you don't have it, because that is at least one thing that you're expected to do night in and night out as far as a student athlete. And so anytime you start off after another loss with, well, I was really happy with the effort that was, stop. I don't want to hear that, because that's just like saying next thing I really want to hear is, and they've all brushed their teeth like good boys. that because to me it's the same thing. Am I wrong there?
No, not at all. Not at all. And I've got to say, that Lady Ball basketball team is, they have so much talent. It is not held accountable. Offensively is the big issue there. Now, they still struggle defensively with things like stopping the basketball. Just make someone dribble around you. If you get in the way of the ball, I do think that also that, offensively, look, I don't know if you watched Louisville against UConn, right? Second half, every play that wasn't a fast break, that wasn't a transition or a run out, was a set play. Tennessee hasn't run a set play, I bet a month and a half. Not one. And Pat didn't used to do that either. She would run three out, two in, and then somebody would beat someone off the dribble, or she'd throw the entry pass in, or maybe there'd be a ball screen. That's it.
But she was also winning national championships and SEC championships. So, with somebody like that, I will give her the benefit of the doubt, all right?
Well, so Geno's changed the game, too. I mean, he did. He came in and he said, hey, we're going to run set plays. We're going to get the best players in the nation right there with Tennessee, and we're going to run set plays, and we're going to run a disciplined offense on top of having a good defense and good rebounding. So, I do think that a couple of years ago, Holly lost the team because she went a little too hard on them. And some of them, I'm not trying to mention anyone in particular, one player in particular couldn't handle it. And that player destroyed the locker room. And I think since then, she's really struggled with being the type of disciplinarian that she needs to be and holding players accountable, especially young players. I think that she's struggled with it.
Well, look, and she's not the first coach, male or female, to make mistakes like that. I mean, I remember the late Bear Bryant used to talk about that all the time, back the mistakes he made in the 60s with the likes of a Joe Namath, et cetera, you know. And all great coaches, they learn from mistakes like that.
And that's the biggest thing, though, this is that she says things like effort. She shut it down and didn't speak publicly for about 3 weeks during that losing streak. I mean, it wasn't pretty. And, you know, people here want her to succeed because she's from here. And so, and also because she's been a longtime loyal assistant. And so people want her to succeed here, but she's not helping herself. I'll just tell you that. She's not helping herself not speaking publicly. She's not helping herself not doing things like Pat did to try to grow the game of women's basketball. And it's frankly kind of sad here right now. They have players. Like, they've done a great job bringing in kind of a recruiting coordinator as one of their assistants. But the ideal situation is Lady Vols get it figured out at the end of the season. They get to the Sweet 16 maybe in the tournament, and then Philip Fulmer tells her, hey, you're on the hot seat. You're bringing in an offensive coordinator, and you have somebody else. The way that the Boston Celtics had to with Doc Rivers, tell him you're taking Tom Thibodeau because you're not good enough at defense, but you're great at what you're doing offensively, and you're great at managing a roster. They need to force an offensive coordinator on her at the end of the day. Just someone that's going to make them go run set plays and run a legitimate offensive system instead of just trying to go beat people off the dribble all day.
We'll wet it up. It was like this. To me, it's like a college football game where a team is trying to go down the field with a game-winning drive, last chance opportunity, and then keeps committing false start after 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 false start, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. To me, that's the way these restrictor plate races are now, like whether it's Daytona or Talladega. That's just not fun for me. It's not the racing that I grew up with. I'll just say that.
No. And look, at the end of the day, NASCAR is going to – they had a nice Daytona 500. That was a much better crowd than they anticipated. The ratings went up for the first time in 3 years, I think, at Daytona. But it's still – but let's be real. It's not what it used to be, and a lot of us, you're not driving a stock car. I think that you're seeing the NBA right now have the same problem that NASCAR had a few years ago, and that's that player empowerment can be a good thing, but there's the law of diminishing returns eventually kicks in. They let the drivers decide, hey, that we're going to have cookie-cutter cars, so we're going to have cookie-cutter tracks. And they want parade driving and things like that because it costs a lot of money if you wreck a race car. It's, you know, a lot safer probably if you're doing parade driving in one single line. So with these restrictor plate races, they want to be able to bunch them up. To me, it's pull the restrictor plate, see who wants some in the corner, and run a stock car. If you don't sell it, you don't run it. And then put the safety features that you need to put on it and keep that uniform. And let the car manufacturers decide what they're going to have inside that car and decide what kind they want to have. I think that it hurts brand identity in the sport. I think that it's hurt the competition just a little bit. I mean, you don't see just kind of, you know, I don't know that you would ever see a Dale Earnhardt in the sport again because of what it takes to get into NASCAR right now, how much money it takes to break into the sport. And so what you're seeing is, you know, 19-year-olds and 18-year-olds and 17-year-old prodigies that are getting rides that you see you'd have to be 24 before you get a look at it. And these, you know, but NASCAR's, they dug this hole themselves by running things poorly, by allowing, and you see this a lot, Johnny, when you see it's not the dad who builds it, or maybe the granddad, and then the son, you know, does a good job. And then by the time you get to the grandson, he runs a dent to the ground. I think right now you have a situation kind of like that is, that it's been running to the ground, and I don't know that it's coming back. I think that the ratings you see every week in NASCAR are the highest ratings you're ever going to see in NASCAR, and it will continue to be that until they just completely revamp the sport.
Well, I mean, look, you can certainly go down that path, too, with college basketball as far as, and I don't know if it's necessarily, in some cases, it's because of the way the sports are run. In other cases, it's just because there's so many opportunities to see you know, other things that are out there as well that kind of like, you know, you've got that pizza, right? And used to, you could have it maybe 6 slices, and now it turns into 100 slices, and it's tougher and tougher. And the strangest part, it's easier to keep up with these events, but because it's also easier to keep up with other things going on in the sports and entertainment world, it just, you know, it kind of waters down the opportunities for one sport over the other. Now, does Knoxville have a racetrack over there? Help me here.
Yeah, you know, we have a lot of small dirt tracks and things like that that are on, but nothing that's large enough. I mean, used to, there were a couple that were in Maryville, Tennessee, which is about 15 miles outside of town, that they used to. The Richard Petty's won that a few times, but nothing that's been run really since the 60s or 70s.
But the reason I bring this up, because you can keep it simple, you know, keep it simple as far as a stock car, but, you know, shorten the season. So instead of starting in February, shorten the actual race season, or if you do start in February, make sure it ends by the end of August before college football kicks in. But I really like the idea of having a midweek race. And I know you start hearing the immediate no-no-nos as far as, well, it's going to be tough to be able to go from a Wednesday city to a Sunday city, et cetera, with all the travel and all that. But if you can make it from an economic standpoint where all the cars, once again, we're talking stock, but I would love to see midweek races, especially when school gets out. So in the months of, end of May, June, July, et cetera, but have these midweek races in sites like in Nashville, like in Birmingham, et cetera. Could it?
Yeah,
I mean, if you can make it work from just a transition standpoint of getting the cars or, your backup cars or whatever the case may be to these midweek races, could you see that being a possibility as a solution? Because as it's going right now, because of the fact that they got greedy and went to markets that nobody cared about, NASCAR and stock car racing, it really hurt the sport. So to get it back, go back to these kind of cities where racing, you grew up with racing.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think you need to keep it in your footprint as well, Midwest and South, right? I mean, let's be real. Phoenix doesn't care. Vegas doesn't care. Texas is fine. I also think that, and I think that midweek racing could work if that you could convince the track owners to change things. They have two choices, right? They can revamp everything, do things like midweek racing, go to Milwaukee, or if you need to, or things like that. Don't let Bruton Smith and his family make all of the money off of NASCAR because they're the ones that own the tracks. But, or they can die. Those are the two options that they have. And I don't know, the unfortunate part is when you start dealing with people who have a lot of ego and that they probably don't look at it and say, if we don't make a change, we're going to die. But they need to do things like that. Look at the summer tracks they have too. You have Daytona in the summer. You have Charlotte in the summer. Other than that, New Hampshire, Pocono, Michigan, a whole lot of tracks that Kentucky, I don't want to see. I mean, I'll just be honest with you. I grew up a racing and I love it. I'm not watching those races. So Watkins Glen, those types of places. And I know you need to get up north and get those tracks done in the summer months, but no one wants to watch it. So you run your sport into the ground. But if you could do things like Knoxville, Iowa, and do it on a dirt track, if you do what you did at Eldora, which is really cool to watch, things like that, I think are the things that, to me, if NASCAR is going to have a future, that is the future.